Ezra, welcome back.
Hey, Ray.
Good to see you, Ezra. Can I start with my usual question?
If you must.
Okay, why are we here?
We have a fascinating two-part episode.
We spoke with Lerner Ekman-Chola, the director of the Women and Gender Studies Program, and a professor of history at MIT.
And a dear colleague.
She agreed to join us on this podcast, and our conversation with her went into historical context of Turkish Armenians and the broader Middle East and post-Ottoman societies. And what this allowed us to do was to understand not only the experiences of Turkish Armenians, but her personal experience in history. She shared with us her journey from Turkey to the U.S., and it's provided her with a unique perspective on dynamics in the U.S. and as they relate to dynamics in Turkey, and also to dynamics in the Middle East.
Yeah, so the first episode will focus on providing historical context for what does it even mean to be a Turkish Armenian? And that itself offers important insights for the broader Middle East post-Ottoman societies. And the second episode, Lerna just takes that and I think offers us some less rehearsed and rawer, more emotional and personal set of reflections about how she feels about the Israel-Palestinian conflict and its impact on campus here at MIT.
Yeah, I really appreciate how much she was willing to share with us at that point.
Yeah.
And so you will not want to miss it. Lerner's lens is unique and uniquely powerful.
Let's get to it. So Ray, we are here today to explore in greater detail two themes that have animated our time together up till now. Number one, the risks, potential risks, that we might fear of providing support to a friend, even when we know that friend is in need of our support. And number two, the importance of what we are calling the outsider-insider relationship as a lens or a perspective on the world. People who are close to us can provide us with an opportunity to see ourselves and therefore the members of other groups more clearly, and maybe zooming out to the larger community, hopefully more clearly.
Right. So this is a skill that'll help us when we're trying to live in a diverse community with people who are different from ourselves.
You got it.
And so we have we're blessed today. We're blessed because we have a guide on this journey. We have a guest. And so I'd like to welcome Lerner Ekman-Chola. So Lerna is a historian of the modern Middle East and the director of the Women and Gender Studies Program at MIT. She specializes in Turkish and Armenian lands in the 19th and 20th centuries. Her work focuses on minority-majority relations and the ways in which gendered analytical lenses help us better understand the coexistence and conflict, including genocide and post-genocide.
So we met Lerna in our common attempt to help the MIT community with the inclusion challenges in the wake of October 7th. We mentioned the Third Space Group, I think, in the last episode, and about the potential universities have to bring people together from different backgrounds and disciplines. And our relationship with Lerna, whom we did not know before October 7th, is a fantastic example of that. Welcome, Lerna.
Hi. So good to be here.
You know, Lerna, I spent most of the morning trying to figure out how to say your last name and Ekman-Chola, and you told me it was correct, but it didn't matter. And so you saying that it didn't matter kind of surprised me. So why didn't it matter? Why doesn't it matter?
Because it's not mine, I guess. It is mine, but at the same time, it's not. Even now I'm thinking it's both like insider, outsider embodied in this one name and a last name next to it. And I mean, the name issue, my personal name, also encapsulates my research, the reason why I entered academia and became a historian.
Wow.
So when I listen to you guys talking about your last name, it really like hit a nerve there that I thought it would be the best place for me to start thinking with you guys about belonging and exclusion and how they coexist in one body in multiple places sometimes at different times, playing itself out differently. So what I mean by this, so last name, my last name is in Turkish, It means a baker's son, actually specifically a bread baker's son.
A bread maker's son?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Because we have both Turks and Armenians, or Muslims and Christians, have patrilineal descent rules.
Right. And we have a lot of anglicized names that have son in the end of them, or man, right?
Yeah.
One of mine, Zuckerman, right?
Yeah, but that's not the most alienating part for me, because it's normalized at this point. I wish it wasn't like that, but it's not the one that's making me think of it as someone else's last name in a way. It's the fact that we as Armenians, so it's a Turkish last name, but I am an Armenian. I identify as Armenian, Christian Armenian, but also the state of Turkey from which I come categorizes me as Armenian, which is one of the three main minorities in Turkey, along with Jews and Greeks. So in 1934, as part of the new post-Ottoman Turkish Republican state's standardization policies, they forced everyone, the citizenry, to have a last name. Many people did not have last names before. And then those last names to be in Turkish specifically. By law and regulation, you had to take a Turkish last name. This was true both for legal minorities, which are non-Muslims, but also for Muslims who are non-Turkish, such as Kurds and Arabs, the main ones, inside Turkey. So these groups also had to Turkify their last names if they had a previous last name. Or when they get a new last name, they had to be in Turkish. So it is a top-down measure to erase difference. We might think about if it's an inclusion policy in a way. It's however forcible it might be. Right? But it is also an assimilationist policy that was against, at the time, many people's wishes, because so many people, they had their own last names. Like in my mom's side, we know what that last name was. And the new last name that they received, the Turkish one, has nothing to do with the original.
Sorry to interject. I just thought for our listeners, it would be interesting to, you know, thinking about our second episode where we talked about this. And we have here something that kind of has some overlap with both the African-American experience and the Ashkenazi, especially Eastern European Ashkenazi Jewish experience that we described, but is distinct, right? So you have, in this case, an alien state, or the state kind of coming in and forcing last names on people, right? So that's similar to what we said about the Ashkenazi Jewish experience. But in this case, there were pre-existing last names. And then it's forcing into a particular linguistic and cultural frame that is, you know, an act of erasure. Whereas in Eastern Europe, the experience of Jews was of adding a last name where they didn't have existing last names, and actually more or less marking them as Jews because the set of last names were different, as opposed to erasing. Like, so some overlap and some difference, right? And then the difference between the African American experience, where there were no last names when you were enslaved. And then they become a marker of, you know, citizenship and identity. And then you might choose within a menu in a particular kind of way.
And it also becomes, in that case, a way of finding each other.
Right.
To be the choices that subjects could make sometimes aligned with, like, not aligned with, but maybe are surprising, as you guys discussed. Why would you get your, like, master's last name?
Right.
But it actually was a way of resisting, I assume, basically. Using this last name of the master, however evil it might be, as a way of reintegrating yourself as a family, as a group, kin. In the Turkish-Armenian case, it acted in both ways. Let me just give you a little bit more background. My first name is Armenian. So the Turkish state forced these last names, but it allowed some leeway with the first names. And Armenians, even those who welcomed this new Turkish last name because it allowed them to possibly pass a little bit easier, at least cosmetically, continued using first names that would signal their non-Turkishness, many times their Armenianness. But Kurds in Turkey, who are the main non-Muslim and potentially dangerous group for Turkish territorial reasons, because they did rebel historically and they had a secessionist movement. For the Turks, Kurds, they didn't allow them, the Turkish state for the longest time, even have Turkish first names.
Wow.
It's a way of suppressing what is seen as seditious potentially. In the Armenian case, what is even more interesting, I think, is that Armenians who remained in Turkey are a distinct group of individuals who survived the Armenian genocide of 1915, a genocide during which happened during World War I in the Ottoman Empire, during which two-thirds of Armenians have been eradicated by the order of their own state. Armenians, this Christian Armenian group, had been living under the Ottoman Turkish rule for about 550 years previously. So they were the subjects of the Ottoman Empire, along with other non-Muslims, mainly the Greeks and the Jews.
And people may not know how far back Armenian identity goes. We're talking, yeah, so 500 years ago, well before.
Yeah, yeah. Armenians are kind of like Jews in this regard, very ancient, knows that they are ancient, proud that they are ancient. And in different from maybe Jews in Europe, however, they are indigenous to the land to which the Ottoman Turkic groups, starting from 11th, 12th century, came from Central Asia. Turks are historically not native. Like, I mean, what is native? What is, when do you become indigenous? These are all interesting and very relevant questions now. But historically, in terms of like built structure, archaeology, from what everything we know, Armenians did originate, what we call now Armenians, originate in what is today Eastern Turkey, around the Lake Van region, what we call Western historic homeland of Armenians. Part of the Eastern historic homeland is in contemporary Armenia.
And the phenomenon of Armenian diaspora, that's a very modern phenomenon.
Overwhelming majority of diaspora Armenians dispersed from the homeland with the pogroms of 1819 in the Ottoman Empire against the Armenians. But it started with that, but the most of them are after the genocide of 1915. But also in the 16th century, 17th century, there are merchant colonies everywhere, Armenian merchants everywhere. For scholastic reasons, Armenians also established different kind of colonies actually in Europe.
And Jerusalem.
And parts of the Middle East and, yeah, South Asia, of course, also, yeah, Jerusalem as well. So, yeah, Ecclesia, it's a big church that has its network everywhere. But the interesting thing, I think, here that connects maybe with the naming question, I'm a historian. What I can contribute, other than who I am, interestingly, happening to be an Armenian from Turkey, who studies the Middle East and who is an expert of the modern Middle East, kind of including Palestine, Israel as well. De facto, I teach this. I don't study it. But other than that part of my identity, it's like just being a historian comes with this added long spiel about how things happened the way they happened. But in this case, naming in the Ottoman Empire, they didn't care about difference. They let difference be until the modern times. So if Armenians had their own last names, it wasn't a problem in the eye of the state, because the goal of the state is not homogeneity or standardization. The flattening of the differences wasn't a big deal. But the state itself would have its own boundary-making mechanisms to render the population legible, governable, as docile as possible. The Ottoman Empire was an Islamic empire, so it was governed mainly by Sharia, Islamic law, according to which non-Muslims who live under Muslim rule have certain rights and entitlements, but also have to accept some deprivations.
And am I right that the rights tended to be communal rather than individual, right?
All communal. You don't exist as an individual in the Ottoman Empire. And your main identity, the card that you carry, is your religion. Life is organized for the subject according to their first religion, and then sex and then their occupation, and then slave-free status.
I think this is perfect, actually, because we've, in a sense, we've talked about the importance of names, and Lerna, what you're illustrating very nicely is we've forgotten the role played by the state. We've made references to it. And right now, Ezra, I'm thinking about imagined communities. So if you don't mind, you mentioned that while everyone was required to Turkify their last names, you were allowed to maintain an Armenian first name, but you also said something about the Kurds. The Kurds had to maintain Kurdish names? Is that correct?
Their first names also had to be Turkified in this case. It's not by law as such, but by practice. And then it becomes a law later in Turkish Republican history in the 1980s when Turks start a civil war inside Turkey for their own autonomous or maybe separate land.
Here you're describing an example where there's an attempt where people might look similar and the name becomes important and the naming practice might limit, you know, a group's ability to identify and mobilize with each other, which I find fascinating.
Yes. And here also language is very crucial, actually. For many nation states, linguistic difference, or like thinking of Anderson's imagined communities, like print media, this dissemination of information, knowledge through your own language, for instance. So the Turkish state, around the same time, which is here, we are talking about 1930s, the last names were Turkified. They also started these campaigns that forced people to speak only in Turkish in public. So the campaign was called Citizens Speak Turkish. That's one of the reasons why, like my parents, my grandparents, they weren't allowed to use Armenian in public. For the Kurdish regions, which is Eastern Turkey, they were forbidden from using their language in school, at home, even in the streets, as a way of neutralizing, again, that potential difference, the difference that had the potential of becoming a political threat.
And there had been tremendous linguistic diversity in the region prior to the nation-building efforts of the new Turkish Republic, right?
Yes. All kinds of pluralism, multiplicity of language, ethnic background, sectarian, religion, in the Ottoman Empire, and this state that is the main state that will inherit the Ottoman Empire is doing everything to turn itself into a nation state, nation being the Turkish state, and therefore sees different as a mortal threat and trying to get away with it as much as possible. In the Kurdish case, it was even more interesting and maybe difficult. They are Muslims. Overwhelming majority of Kurds are Muslims. And therefore, they are seen as having a potential to be Turkified fully. But with Jews and Armenians, there is like ontological impossibility of becoming Turks because of the religion component.
Because of their religion.
And I assume Greeks.
Mm-hmm. Armenians are Christian.
All Armenians.
Right. And so although the Kurds... You know, the Kurds are Muslim,
right?
And the Turks are I'm not sure always Muslim, but
almost always.
And Lerna, could you say a word about the Greeks too, right? Because Greeks would presumably be always other as Christian, right? But then many of them were exiled, right?
So yes, the Greeks are also an officially designated non-Muslim group in the Ottoman Empire. So there is a term for it actually in Islam called dimmi. Or Zimmi in Turkish, which means those non-Abrahamic, technically it really refers only to Jews and Christians, who have been conquered by a Muslim ruler, Muslim state, and instead of converting to the right faith, in this case Islam, they chose to keep their original faith, but therefore have to defer now. They therefore accepted their secondary status in this entity. They will be left alone most of the time as long as they do these extra things. For instance, paid extra tax. It's instead of sending their sons to the army, for instance. Like there are or they accept that they cannot ride horses, or they cannot carry weapons so that they don't mobilize, they don't rebel against. Okay, so this demi status was given to Jews and other Christians. Greeks are part of that. So I'm not using minority because it's an anachronistic term. The Ottoman Empire did not use it because religion kept its career, actually, in the post-Ottoman Turkish nation state as well. Well, it was with us in this part of the world, Middle East, which was under the Ottoman Empire for 600 years, right? Including in Palestine and Jerusalem, all those regions. It was so relevant to most things, almost all things, that you couldn't get rid of it, really, in a way that the international law also backed. That Lausanne Treaty that the Turkish side in 1923 signed with the British, the main victor of World War I, insisted that some groups in Turkey need to have extra protections because they are different. And where does their difference come from? From religion specifically. It wasn't linguistic, it wasn't ethnic, racial, nothing. And it really mirrored in terms of the way that the groups were at least understood, not specified as such in the treaty itself, but it was Greeks, Jews, and Armenians, the main three groups in the Ottoman Empire they carried. So in the Ottoman Empire, the dominant group is the Turkish Muslim. Yes, there's class differences. There are a lot of Turkish Muslim poor people, right? Like how the United States is, there's white privilege. They are the top unmarked group, right? Like the normative group is the white group. In the Ottoman Empire, it was the Muslim Turk. Therefore, even if you unveil or whatever you do, still in the post-1923 Turkey, yes, all these minorities looked at the space around them, despite all the changes, as being dominated by white Turks. But in this case, it's very interesting and different from other post-genocidal societies or here in the United States, white, black or white, indigenous difference. The groups, let's keep it specifically on Christians, because Turkey is trying to be westernized and West has Christian norms and legacies. So what happens is that around the same time that the names are being Turkified, Turkey, the state, decides that the day of rest is going to move from Friday, which is, of course, the Muslim holiday, to what day? It's not Thursday or Tuesday or Saturday, but Sunday. Sunday becomes the day of rest. In 1926, the Ottoman Turkish letters, which are in Arabic letters, they forcibly converted, like overnight, to Latin. That's why Turkish is now written in Latin alphabet.
So if I understand correctly, the irony I was going to mention is what you're saying is at the same time that as, you know, post-genocidal Turkish Armenians are experiencing kind of the dominance of, even though with religion kind of in the background, a Muslim space that they have to navigate in, and there's this flattening and suppressing of Christian identity generally and Armenian identity in particular, you're also seeing this kind of deference to the Christian inflected order of the world, right? With this move to Sunday and then other kinds of more broadly Western that are generally speaking Christian privileging norms that are reflected in the emerging Turkish society and polity. Is that correct?
Yeah, the irony, and that is why I argue Armenians in post-genocide Turkey in these early years could survive that new Turkey, because increasingly the perpetrator majority was trying everything to look like them. Right, like when Sunday became the day of rest, Armenian was like,
made it easier.
Elevated. Yeah. Imagine the whole United States changing everything to your calendar, like your
to a Jewish calendar,
syncopated life. And exactly. But I think the elephant in the room in this case is the term civilized or civilization. Like the leading ideology of Turkey at this point is being civilized, being seen as civilized. The Turkish state, Kemalist state's goal main goal was to be able to reach to the level of Western civilization. Whoever had the means to over-dominate the discourse, basically. Whatever a Belgian was doing in Congo wasn't seen as barbarian. Or American slavery wasn't seen as barbarian, right? With the white Anglo-Saxon mind. But when the Turks did it to their own people, it was seen as barbarian. Turks are aware of this. This double standard is a very major foundational defensive logic in the Turkish mind. But regarding those changes, this, again, insider-outsider thing, with specifically the Armenians, is interesting because this majority that tried to eliminate Armenians, and successfully so, they did. No Armenia was established in that land, that particular land, and they did build their own Turkey on that land, that includes what Armenians wanted as their homeland. So we are talking about a place, a group in which the victim is not seen as barbarian or savage or less in the civilizational hierarchy. Because they are Christian, because actually they are one of the first Christian nations, and because they've had so many ties with the West historically, educationally, they had their own language for such a long time. The same state that hates Armenians is also admiring its Armenians because of their connections with Christianity.
So in a sense, privileging or paying deference to what were more Armenian practices at the time, right? And then the other thing I wanted to mention is, I think one of the things that's distinctive about anti-Semitism, and that I think has some echoes in what you're describing about anti-Armenianism in Turkey, is the sense that this particular group is, in some sense, even though they are seen as a problem and outsiders, but in some sense, actually as above, not below, right? That they have a certain kind of power, put it that way. And they're a threat because of that power rather than being, right? You're nodding.
Totally. Yeah, that's it. They're scared of it. That's one of the reasons why they organized this large scale effort to annihilate them. But at the same time, they value, admire, and aspire to it. Mm. I mean, there's so many connections, right? Like when missionaries comes Western from Boston, all these evangelical that were from France, Catholics, they work with Armenians in the Ottoman Empire. They try to convert Jews, doesn't happen. Converting Muslims is an apostasy. You cannot leave Islam, right? So missionaries were not allowed to work with Muslims. So they worked with Ottoman Armenians. So many Ottoman Armenians increasingly looked like Americans.
Mm.
So we see from 1910s on, Ottoman Armenians coming to the United States to Ivy League schools, great schools, getting an education with the hopes that these missionaries will return them back to their homes and will enlighten them. And that becomes an Armenian ideology, which we see with Zionism also similarly, that in their aspirations for reform or statehood, they would use this trope of we are the enlightened factor of the group element of the Orient. We can spread this
civilization
amongst groups.
But Lerna, what you've been sharing helps us to understand why when we were talking about the challenges that we were having on the campus in the fall, and how you mentioned how you were able to identify with both Jews and Palestinians.
Yes.
I mean, this kind of gives us some insight into that answer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, you're in a unique position, I think, mm-hmm. right? To do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was it ever difficult, is what I would ask you? Were you ever forced to choose?
Always, unfortunately. But I always refuse to be reduced to that framework of choice. It's irrelevant for me.
Say more, please, Lerna.
This is when it gets more less rehearsed, because I speak about this with my family, maybe very close friends. But it's not as rehearsed as the previous. Because the previous, whatever we talked, is also part of my research I teach.
Right.
Okay. So I'm trying to think how I can find a way of not starting with historical. Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to conclude this first part of our discussion in this episode right here. You know, Ray, you and I thought this was a really natural place for us to pause, given how much Lerner has already given us in this first part to reflect on about the historical context and the unique insight that she can therefore offer us as someone who, in one person, embodies both insider and outsider. And folks should tune in for part B, shouldn't they, Ray?
I think they should. It's fascinating. You know, it's hard for someone to be so emotionally close to a situation and yet maintain the ability to provide really deep insights. And I think those are challenges that we're grappling with right now. And I think there's a real opportunity for us to learn.
Stay tuned, folks.
I'm Ray Reagans.
I'm Ezra Zuckerman-Sivan.
You've been listening to Outsider.
Insider.
A podcast from MIT.
Special thanks for this episode to our dear colleague and friend, Lerna Ekmucholu.
And as always, we're grateful to our producer, Lucy McCormick.
And executive producer, Kate O'Sullivan.
With help from consulting producer, Hamid Albadi.
And mixed by Hansdale Shee.